Hello and welcome to Prospect Barbacast, the only podcast in the world wishing you a happy Ethan holiday season. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and we are joined by Uncle Mike Farron. Hello, everybody. See, people know about Jackson Holiday, they know about Matt Holiday, some even know about Ethan Holiday. But did you know there's another brother?
No, there is a third
happy?
One coming.
Is that Happy Holiday?
There it is. There's Mike. You would have to imagine that at some point that joke was made when they were naming their children. But no, we are not going to talk about the Holiday family, at least I don't think too much on this episode of Prospect Barbacast.
I'm very disappointed that Jake left out both Josh, who is the head coach at Oklahoma State, and Tom, who's like one of the great college coaches of all time. But whatever. I mean,
we're looking forward, not back looking. Okay. We're trying to see if there's more, you know, future number one overall picks coming. I know, credit to Josh and Tom, they're still relevant to some degree, but we're looking ahead here, especially on this podcast for come on.
That family is like the Jewish calendar, Jordan. Too many holidays to know about, but we're not going to focus on that. On this edition of Prospect Barbacast, we are going to chat about the spring breakout that was announced. We'll get into what that is, why it's cool, why we like it, why we don't. Maybe we don't, maybe we do. We'll see. We're going to talk about the San Francisco Giants catching situation in the wake of the landmark Tom Murphy signing, the reverberations which were felt as far east as New York City, where I'm sitting. We'll talk about short pitching kings and give a description of the 20 to 80 scale. As a reminder, if you're listening to this and you're like, where's Baseball Barbacast? Monday, Friday. On Wednesdays, we talk about prospects and everything in the world of baseball development, prospecting, and whatnot. Anything else before we hop into spring breakout, my friends?
I'm excited. I'm excited to get into this. And I know, Mike, this is a good topic to start here with the announcement from Major League Baseball of, I don't know if you'd call this an initiative. I don't know how you would describe this. But what this is, which they are dubbing Spring Breakout, is essentially a series of exhibitions in spring training starting this year between organizations with teams exclusively made up of their top prospects. Now, my understanding is each team will only be doing one of these games, does it seem like there might be more than
there's
one?
A couple that are doing two, because there's an odd number of teams, right, in Florida and in Arizona. So the Cardinals are playing two, the Reds are playing two as well. But this is like one of the great thrills of spring training. I really like, listen, you guys know, and you have the same sickness that I do, in that we'll watch baseball all day, every day in any form. But probably the most tedious form of baseball to watch is spring training baseball. And the best parts of spring training baseball is when you get to see players that you haven't seen before, whether that be players that are new to your major league team or players that are coming up through the minors. And so this gives a great opportunity as a bunch of doubleheaders over the span of a 4-day, over a 4-day span in March, for after the major league game to conclude on the big league spring training field, there's going to be a prospect head-to-head matchup. And so we'll get a chance to see, and I'm sure some of these games will be covered on radio and television too, about 50 or so of the best prospects in each organization, or 25 of each in each organization, go head to head. And I think that's pretty cool. I'm assuming that there's going to be some, you know, like maybe some guys that are on the 40 man that are in major league camp may not be available to it. But overall, I think it's a really great idea. And it certainly jives with what MLB is trying to do in create more awareness for the minor leagues. They've wanted this initiative over the last several years, where they have paid more attention, or wanted to pay more attention to prospects, so that when they get to the big leagues, people already know who they are. And kind of this this idea that, you know, prospects are suspects until proven otherwise has been thrown to the side, so that people can get excited about future players and argue about them and decide which ones they want to trade and which ones they want to keep.
I think MLB has looked around at other sports and has seen the extent to which the drafts are events in and of themselves. And it is difficult to blow up a MLB draft at that level without educating fans about prospects. because if you are able to watch the draft and then your those players disappear for 2 or 3 years, you're less compelled to want to tune in. And I think what MLB is trying to do here is to make that pipeline more accessible to people. And it's a no doubt obvious good thing. There is one downside, though, that I thought of, which is if you are a fan of a team with a really shitty farm system, you're then forcing your fans to watch all of those players at once.
Well, that's like, it is.
Like, I was looking at some of the matchups, right? It's like, are there any incredibly lopsided showdowns where it's like one stacked system?
Oh, against sure. One? I mean, if we were,
I mean, the Red Sox Braves, yeah. Right? Like right off the top, that's one that it's like, ooh, boy, that's a big difference.
Yeah, no, and that's true. I mean, I would say that, of course, if we're talking about a single game, I have to imagine that most of these will be able to avoid. I don't know how many pitchers are running out there if we're doing one inning or how that's right. All going to be structured. I am interested in you make the reference to the draft and other sports, and I think we've talked a lot about this in recent years.
Dodgers, Angels. Oh, that's, man.
That's pretty rough. That's pretty rough. So, again, it would be more fun if you're doing full series, right? Then we'd really start to understand the discrepancy. But, again, you mentioned the draft, and, like, I think as much as, you know, we all love the draft and want it to get more attention building up to it and teaching people about amateur prospects in college and in high school, I think this is way easier because the reality is we're fans. And sure, you could say, oh, who do you want your guy to take or your team to take in with the 17th pick? But ultimately, if you know this guy's already part of my organization, this guy's already put up stats in the minor leagues of maybe even double A, right? It's something like if I know this guy is going to be coming to the major leagues at some point soon and impact my favorite team, that's as much incentive to watch it as anything. Now, I really hope that as much of this as possible is televised, because that would feel like, obviously, spring training is a thing where people buy tickets for this, but like this is a very key detail, and I haven't seen any specific promises about that, but I do hope that that is a part of this, because again, to your point, Mike, about like whether we've seen them before, like literally like seeing what they look like in a major league uniform, spring training is such a big part of that, but normally it's so unpredictable and random. Now, sometimes you get to see top guys get in the starting lineup of a spring training game. But for the most part, it's like, oh, holy shit, this, you know, top 50 guy just subbed in the sixth inning. Is the game televised? Oh, it's not, right? And then it's like, okay, well, what am I supposed to do with that as a fan who's maybe not in Arizona or not in Florida? So I think concentrating it and structuring and organizing it is a brilliant idea. And I really do like that effort, even if, again, I hope that it can all get its proper promotion and, you know, particularly from a television standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that famous clip from a Cardinals spring training game about 10 years ago when late Oscar Tavares came in and nobody knew who he was, and it said minor league guy on the screen, right?
That was right.
One of the best outfield prospects in baseball. So, and I think the other thing, I mean, to your point on, you know, listen, like I would like to see the draft get bigger. I think college baseball in particular is pretty accessible if you are in college towns or near college towns, especially as the weather gets better in the north. It's a great way to go and see quality baseball cheap, especially in the bigger conferences. But minor league baseball in the, you know, 120 different municipalities that have it is pretty accessible. And there is a chance, depending on what region you live in, that your favorite team's prospects are coming through at some point. Who knows if seeing someone in spring training or on TV during a spring training game and you go, oh, yeah, that player is going to end up, let's say, in, you know, Midland, you know, and let's say you're an A's fan that's living in Dallas, right? Like, you know, I can get a chance to see them when they play in the Texas League, you know, at a stop that's close to me. So I think there's and I think the other is that, you know, if there's elite level prospects and you happen to live in a spot and you hear on one of these broadcasts that, hey, they're going to be playing close by, you may make it a point to go see them too. So, I mean, I think a lot of minor league baseball, you know, this is a little bit different than what I think a lot of minor league baseball is, at least from the fan standpoint. From the standpoint, it's going to see at a game affordably and making great, you know, family entertainment. Mm-hmm. But for some people, the hardcore baseball fans, it's a chance to see the biggest names before they get big, or to try and sit, tell your friends, hey, I was in on the ground floor on this guy. So I think it's pretty exciting. I'm really looking forward to seeing how this plays out. And really, I'm more than anything, I'm looking forward to see how this grows over the next several years, because this is not something they're going to do just once. No.
I'm excited to have something that just breaks up the monotony of spring training.
Yeah.
Like by the middle end of March, I'm ready to just.
I mean, I've watched less and less spring training every year, really, even since.
Well, it's because we're watching college baseball.
I know. That's 100% correct. Like that, I have no, and it is the opposite because, you know, one of our favorite parts, of course, about watching college baseball is that the games matter on February 18th, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas going from that, even if before you get into conference play to the game, to it's the opposite of that, we're going through the motions. But that is what gets me to tune in to a spring training game, is knowing that a top 100 prospect is in the lineup or a top 100 prospect is on the mound for the first couple innings. That is always what gets my attention and will continue to. So to have it all concentrated, I think is a great idea.
What do we think about the name? And then we'll move on. Mm. Spring Breakout. It reminds me of the April of my 10th grade year. Oh. Right before I went on Accutane. That was my spring breakout.
Yeah. Did that line up right around that same time? Now, are any of these prospects young enough to still be getting acne? Probably.
Jackson Holliday definitely looks like he's young enough to still have it, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. These are the oily-faced youth of America.
It should be spring breakout brought to you by Neutrogena.
I am curious, like something I am fascinated by is maybe not really strategy, but like how different teams choose. Because it seems like the teams are going to have the option. They're basically designating their roster, which is kind of a fascinating exercise in and of itself. And I know the 40-man considerations will make it, but like they're almost going to have to tell us who they view as their top prospects. And in that sense, I think, I know it's one game, but I think we could also learn a lot from that. And I'm also curious too about, this is a fun part of the futures game also, is you see, again, a lot of range. Guys that have been, that just crushed AA, guys that haven't even played an A-ball yet, but you know, are extremely promising, that maybe just got drafted out of high school. Seeing all those guys on the same field kind of helps us calibrate, you know, where all of these guys are at in their development.
Yeah, and I think well, I'm curious to see, because we've seen it with futures games over the years too, which teams aren't necessarily sending their best prospects to it if there are some that withhold them from this game.
Yeah,
I would think that the league probably wouldn't be particularly happy for that. But I think you're right that there's a sense of you can get at least a feel for what some internal evaluations may feel like and where they might differ from some of the publicly available lists. I think the other thing is that it gives you a chance to have a showcase event for some of these players, you know, especially for, like, let's say the Reds, who are likely to be in contention this year and still have a pretty decent farm system. It's two looks against high level competition for a number of their guys that scouts are going to get. Now, obviously not on consecutive days, and the level of pitching could vary depending on who they're playing. You know, the game against Cleveland probably involves maybe a little bit more velocity than some of the guys against Texas, although Texas Rangers certainly have a deep enough farm system to make things really interesting in something like that. I mean, they're pretty loaded with position player group in particular. But I think it's you know, it's a good chance for scouts to be able to evaluate them on a little bit bigger stage with a little bit more pressure too. And even though they're kind of one-off looks, I know enough scouts that still find value in all-star games like that to see how players handle that and perform against the best competition. How do your, not necessarily results look, but how do you, how quality are your at-bats? How about the ways that you, attack hitters, all of that?
Let's change gears and go from the future to the past and turn our attention to San Francisco, California, where the Giants recently signed Tom Murphy to be their backup catcher, 2-year, $8 million deal. Now, why are we discussing a 32-year-old catcher on Prospect Barbacast? That is because Tom Murphy's signing bumps a gentleman by the name of Joey Bart to fourth, not even third, probably fourth, on the Giants catching depth chart behind Murphy, their starter Patrick Bailey, and Blake Sable, who does some catching, does some outfield, does some DHing, a little bit of everything. And the reason this is relevant is because Joey Bart was the number two pick in the draft in 2018. Number two pick in the draft in 2018. And here we are heading into 2024. He has no options left. He will almost certainly start the year, what, in
on another team.
In another organization.
Yeah. He will not be. I mean, everything about this move, and you could argue whether, you know, Sable's definitely going to, he was their Rule 5 pick, whether he's going to start in the big leagues next year. But this would seem to be the end of Joey Bart in San Francisco. And I wanted to kind of bring this up as a topic because I was curious about, you know, Mike's kind of memories as Joey Bart as a prospect. And listen, there's a million, you know, top 10 picks that don't end up being what we expect. But I think this one in particular is one in this moment of the Giants moving on from Joey Bart is a moment that I've kind of been wondering about since they took Patrick Bailey in the first round 2 years after him. And I know in baseball, you're not necessarily drafting, you know, for need all the time, and you're going to take the best player no matter what. But that really said a lot to me at the time. And I know they've had some change in leadership over the last few years that has maybe hinted at, you know, who, what they would be prioritizing and the kind of players that they would be giving every chance, you know, to earn their spot as part of the Giants' future. But this is a it's not surprising considering how Joey Bart has looked as a major leaguer, but it is an interesting thing to kind of reflect upon as to kind of where this went wrong and then how they, you know, ended up with Patrick Bailey, who I also think is a really interesting future to project out. So let's go back to kind of maybe when Joey Bart was a prospect, if that seems like a good place to start, Mike, or did you have any other?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I mean, Bart was viewed as a power hitting catcher coming out of Georgia Tech who had pretty unique feel for calling the game. I remember Kylie McDaniel from ESPN telling a story about when Bart was for midweek games, he would call local area scouts to try and get information on scouting reports for guys that they may not have had. And this is right about the time that Synergy was starting to take hold, which is a computer program that gets you access to a lot of the minor league and amateur video. But he was calling to try and get information on guys to try and learn how to pitch them. He was viewed as a pretty polished, complete player coming to the Giants with a surefire future behind the plate. And the power certainly showed up in the low minor leagues. And then 2020 happened and he kind of got rushed to the big leagues despite the fact
what happened?
That was the only thing that happened.
You were trapped inside. Yeah, you were trapped
inside. Joey Bart was rushed to the big leagues.
9 months, yeah. You know, playing at the alternate site, Buster Posey had opted out of the season. The Giants needed help at catcher. And, you know, he was coming up on a year that he needed to be added to the 40-man roster anyway. And it didn't go well. He looked like a player who was overmatched a lot of times at the big league level. I think the other thing that has kind of plagued Bart, and I think we should probably get into this deeper, is that there have been some questions about his makeup and the way he's acted around your players. I know scouts have not always been a big fan of his. I mean, I'll give you a little bit more on that in a little bit on some of what I've heard, both good and bad on him. But it seemed like people had soured on him. And I think the biggest thing is, and this really shows up pretty much throughout his professional statistical line, is that he never really mastered the strike zone particularly well. You know, he was never a guy that you know, was making consistently great swing decisions to be able to tap into the power. And I think even, you know, in a limited sample in Double A in 2019, it's one of those reasons why I think now in retrospect, now that we have a much clearer mind 3 years after the 2020 season, it should have been a little bit surprising that he was, you know, forced to the big leagues at that level. I mean, he's got a full season's worth of major league at-bats now, 503, right, which would qualify you for a season. He's hit 219, 288, 335 for a slash line. That's 22% worse than the league average hitter. And power, having been his calling card, has been well below average, not just in terms of his home run total, but if you that slug on a low batting average isn't great. And he struck out in more than a third of his plate appearances. So I think some of it speaks to how difficult it is to evaluate amateurs, how difficult professional baseball is. And I think it also speaks to, you know, right then was when there was a change in that organization on how they were going to evaluate players, because that was, you know, the number two overall pick, Brian Sabian was in charge of that by 2020. Farhan Zaidi was the head of baseball operations, and Patrick Bailey was drafted despite some questionable offensive skills, which I think are still questionable there, but he's viewed as a good receiver with a strong arm, and the defensive value has shown up much more statistically than it had to this point for Bart.
I want to talk for a second when you use the word swing decisions. I think that is a phrase that has become, you know, part of the scouting, player development, player analysis lexicon over the last 5 years. And it is both a very simple concept and something that is worth digging deeper into. So when Mike says swing decisions, he is saying, what are the pitches that Joey Bart is swinging at and when and where, right? And that is any number of different stats. So that is in zone swing rate, that is out of zone swing rate, that is edge swing rate, which is an important one, and that depends on the count. And you see this manifesting itself in the skill sets of players or in the production of players like Gunnar Henderson. We talked about this yesterday, Jordan, off the air. Like Gunnar Henderson's 2023 is a great example of how swing decisions impact your production. The beginning of the season, Gunnar Henderson was barely swinging at anything in the strike zone. He became more aggressive, turned into a different hitter. But in Bart's case, right, the issue with his swing decisions is more about his O swing. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, his in-zone contact is shockingly low.
So the league average zone contact rate this past season was 85.4. What percentage of pitches in the strike zone are you putting in play, right? Bart's career in-zone contact rate is 76.7, almost 10 points below the league average. And when you are missing that often in zone, you are going to get attacked more in zone. And that is going to be a bigger issue. I know you're still saying, hey, 3 out of 4 times when he swings at a pitch in the zone, he's making contact. That's still a pretty low number relative to what you would expect.
And I think the other part, just to finish on that, was that swing and miss extended outside the strike zone, he actually doesn't chase a ton. It's a little bit, it's right around the league averages, at least in terms of his plate discipline and his limited major league career. But when he does swing outside the zone, he swings and misses at a much higher rate than the average.
So that's actually less than, that's not exactly swing decisions, right? His decision
because if you're swinging at pitches outside the strike zone.
That's the first part, yeah.
Yeah, it's you're choosing which pitches to swing at, right? So goes into swing decision.
His O swing, his out of zone swing is 35.4. League average is 31. So it's a little bit above league average, basically his chase rate. But the issue, in my opinion, and why he has struggled is that it's not just the chase rate. There are many good hitters with a 35% chase rate. It's more that he is not making significant contact on pitches in the strike zone.
Now, if you are to be a little bit more generous, you say, all right, well, but he really hasn't had that much consistent run of major league at-bats. And yes, if you put together the total, it goes over 500, but he hasn't really done it. Now, not that his numbers in the upper minors have been particularly, promising in that sense. But I think as we kind of spin this to Patrick Bailey, I think that's where the comparison becomes really interesting, because Patrick Bailey, in terms of also came out of draft having put up monster numbers in the ACC, but he also came with a really, really strong defensive reputation, the kind that Joey Bart seemed to have. You kind of alluded to maybe the game calling and the game preparation, but Patrick Bailey, again, if we want to, kind of veer into some of the makeup stuff and how he interacts with his teammates, his pitching staff, how you are counting on him to get better and improve in every facet of the game, I'm sure you've had this experience, because I know you talk to people love Patrick Bailey. People are obsessed with how from the Giants people that I spoke to this year, there was an extreme adoration for him as a game caller, as a game manager, as a catcher, and that character. He carries a lot of the same offensive concerns. I know he had a strong start to his rookie season. He tailed off because he too was swinging at everything, even more aggressive, never walking, swinging at a ton of stuff, all over the place, swinging and missing. But that defensive aptitude and that foundation that he has, which is mostly elite framing and elite control of the running game, that has essentially fortified his role with the Giants in some form in the offense, we will see. But I sense that they were very ready to kind of move on to him once he had shown that he was able to kind of hack it at the big league level as soon as Bart was.
Well, and that's what you saw, and that's why he ended up taking over as their starting catcher. Now, the throwing, he got off to a great start throwing, and it kind of changed as the season went on. You're always going to revert to the mean a little bit, right? So he got a little bit closer to league average. It's unique, too. He throws more like an infielder, right? It's a very low arm slot, almost like a shortstop that he throws from, and yet, for the most part, he's accurate with it. And you're right. Like, the defensive reputation is very, very strong because he does these quantifiable things really well. He's a very good receiver. He gets extra strikes on the edges of the strike zone. He is able to control the running game. The game calling is a little bit different. In that we don't have a really great way to quantify that, but he was a very valuable player this year, despite the fact that he was not a good offensive player. And he did so, you know, he was basically an above average regular almost solely on his defense, playing fewer than 100 games. Mm-hmm. And so it's impressive there. You know, in talking to some Giants people, not everybody thought that Joey Bart wasn't willing to work. There were people who said that he put in the work, that mm-hmm. wasn't an issue, that he was trying hard. And I think if you look at, you know, again, a limited sample this year, there were some improvements that looked like in terms of in zone swing, in zone contact there. There's certainly not the power potential with Bailey that there was with Bart. But you're also talking about a guy who's 26, almost 27 years old, and Bailey's a little bit younger. And even if he doesn't produce much offensively, you know, he has proven that he can receive at the big league level. And now he needs to do it again. I mean, I think this is the part that is a little bit tricky in all of this, is that they've kind of run out of time on Bart, right? Like, he's out of options. If you're going to sign another catcher, it means you're not keeping him most likely, and he's going to get another opportunity someplace else. But the numbers really did get much worse as the year went on for Patrick Bailey.
Oh, yeah.
Enough so that they started to look fairly similar to Joey Bart's. Mm-hmm. In the second half of last season, Bailey hit under 200 with a slugging percentage that was in the 250s.
Right.
And while his walk rate improved closer to the league average, he was striking out nearly 30% of the time. So it's, and that's even with a strong August. I mean, a really strong August. Now, maybe he wore out at the end of September. Maybe August was an outlier in terms of the walk totals, because it certainly doesn't line up with the rest of the season. But like, as much as we feel like we got really good information on Bailey's defense last year, it still is not
totally
a book that's been written, right? We have this one chapter in it.
Yeah,
and it still feels a little odd that a guy who was a draft pick 2 years after the number two overall pick has clearly supplanted Joey Bart as the catcher for the Giants, even when accounting for the struggles of Bart in the upper minors, when you start looking at what Bailey's offensive line has been like. So it's a really tricky situation for them overall. And Bart is going to benefit from a change of scenery, I would think. I think it's probably, you know, sometimes through no fault of a player's own or no fault of the organization even, you end up with a guy who, you know, doesn't necessarily fit what an organization's trying to do. And it might be that that's part of what Bart gets.
Yeah.
The important part with Bailey here is that with his defensive reputation and defensive output at the beginning of this season, he earned himself the opportunity to improve at the big league level, mm-hmm. which is what Bart did not earn himself, right? And that is the difference to me. That is the distinction. In a year, we could be saying, oh, well, Patrick Bailey can't hit at the big league level.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But we don't know that. And he is going to have every opportunity to fail because of what it means to be an above average defensive catcher. Jordan, I'll kick it to you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Mike, I was just going to say, the last thing I was just going to say on this is to your point, right? Like, as exciting as Bailey's defense was, to your point, like, we don't know yet. And mm-hmm. that maybe he's proven enough defensively that we know he's going to have some sort of major league role, where Joey Bart still has something to prove, I think, even on that sense. And I think he'll have that opportunity elsewhere. I mean, this is, they've been searching here, right? And it's not just, you think, okay, they're trying to find their catcher after Buster Posey. They haven't really hit at the top of the draft since Buster Posey. I mean, this has been a really rough run of Giants drafts at the very top. They have, you go through those names, and it goes back as recently as, unfortunately for a guy like Hunter Bishop, that we saw who's mm-hmm. certainly struggled in a big way. He was the 10th overall pick, you know, the year after Bart. But you go before that. I mean, we got Hylio Ramos, big leaguer, sort of. Phil Bickford, of course, never impacted them there. Chris Shaw, Tyler Beede, Christian Arroyo. You know, Joe Panic was like a solid player for them. But it's been after that run of they went Mad Bum, Posey, Zach Wheeler in three straight years, which is about
strong,
as good as you're going to get in three straight, you know, top 10 picks. Since then, it's been very, very, very little. And for them to then, you know, still be looking again, especially for that catcher, that anchor that they were so used to having with Posey, they're gonna, it's, that's a tough thing to kind of work around, and we'll see with Bailey. I'm a fan, but I do agree that it is far from certain that he is 100% the answer as the full-time guy.
Yeah, and I think the other part too is that, like, the question, there are a lot of questions still on their last couple of first round picks too.
Yeah,
like Will Bednar, who's the brother of Pirates closer David Bednar, has battled some back issues that have left him not, he's been ineffective when he's pitched, but he just hasn't been able to pitch much because of injury. Reggie Crawford was a two-way player they took out of UConn in the first round of 2020, who'd missed the previous season because of Tommy John surgery. Big arm, hasn't really pitched much yet in pro ball. And Bryce Eldridge was a two-way player out of high school. And so they really have not shown that they have been able to get over the hump. I mean, the most valuable first-round pick that they've taken, maybe outside of Bailey, in the last, what, since Joe Panik, you could make the case as Chris Stratton.
Yeah, which, I mean, that's, again, who didn't do much with the Giants, if anything, right?
So, who, by the way, was just on the Royals season ticket sale hype poster. Do you think Chris Stratton was ever on a hype poster at Mississippi State? Yeah. It was, and I can't decide whether or not Chris Stratton or Garrett Hampson being on that was better.
Right. So,
Royals,
and,
baby.
And listen, again, and by the way, Tim Lincecum, of course, was 06 too. I didn't even mention him. So, like, that's four in a row. That's just, like, unbelievable. But it's been rough. I mean, there have been a couple, and sure, you could sort of pick and choose this with a lot of drafts. It's really hard. It's really hard. But they've struggled to really supply, you know, support that, the their ability to find late bloomers and other, you know, core pieces through other ways. Of course, they've had a lot of homegrown guys, but missing on the top of the draft that often can put you in a delicate spot, especially when it's the same position over the span of a few years. All right, let's take a break. And when we return, we're going to talk about some short kings. Let's talk about some short kings. The short guys. Let's talk about. We'll be right back on Prospect Barbecue.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, Mike Farron. Mike, how tall are you?
My listed height is 5'10".
Ooh. Yeah.
But now you can't lie about it anymore because, you know.
It'll affect the automated ball strike. Yeah.
Would you describe Mike as an undersized baseball analyst? Is he undersized? Are we undersized? Because if we were pitchers, I'm just going to say, if we were pitchers, I'm 5'10 and change. Jordan's 5'11. Mm-hmm. Are we undersized starting pitchers? Yes. Are we undersized baseball commentators?
No shit.
Absolutely chance. Not. Shouts no out to Ken Rosenthal and Jeff Passan.
So, yeah.
What it's all context that, dependent, baby.
I mean, I think I'm kind of the Rich Garces of this. Do you guys remember El Guapo, right? He was little undersized, portly right-hander.
That's Mike.
Lovable.
That's Mike, all right. Now, what we are going to talk about, again, you know, we think about this on Prospect Barbercast, but think about it a little bit more bigger picture, you know, and we've had a lot of conversations, of course, about Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who, as we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, still has not signed, and we'll see, and he's listed at 5'10 and has often referred to as an undersized right-hander. Also had reports on Tuesday that the Padres are signing left-handed reliever Yuki Matsui, also one of the better pitchers in MPB over the last decade or so. Now, that's a reliever, but still,
how tall
he's listed at 5'8. And when you watch highlights of Yuki Matsui, you're like, yep, that guy's 5'8. There is no lying about that.
He and I share something in common. We both look up to Mike Farron.
when you combine that with not just Yamamoto Matsui, but Shota Imanaga, another Japanese pitcher listed at 5'10, and the fact that really the two most successful quote unquote short pitchers of the last 10 years were both free agents this offseason, one of which has already signed in Sonny Gray with the Cardinals, and Marcus Stroman, who remains on the open market. I think this is a topic worth considering here. I know, Mike, you referenced a story written by one of our favorite baseball writers that we know, Alex Speer of the Boston
former
Globe.
Guest.
Kind
former
of a guest. Former guest, of course, about this topic. But I figured we'd bring it here to the show because I think it is an interesting one that is certainly fresh because of the names we just mentioned. But also when we start to project and think about what teams are valuing and what we could expect to see as baseball evolves, kind of, I was curious where you kind of stood on this.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this was a topic of discussion much more 15, 20 years ago than it has been of late. There was a feeling that short pitchers could not hold up. And I think it's one of the reasons why the Astros moved Billy Wagner very quickly to the bullpen in the minor leagues. And Wagner is listed at 5'8", and obviously was one of the most dominant relief pitchers of all time. For my money, he should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, if you compare him to his peers, he really was without comparison at run prevention. But, you know, Wagner and Roy Oswalt, who was there as his contemporary, were kind of seen as unique in that regard. And this was a big part of discussion when Sonny Gray was drafted out of Vanderbilt was, well, he's small. So is he going to be able to hold up? And certainly Gray has had injuries, but no more so than many other taller pitchers. It does feel like the more that some of these biases that were passed down through, I guess, for lack of a better term, oral tradition over, you know, 70 plus years of baseball evaluation, with more information have gone by the wayside. And I think in this case, a lot of it has to do with biometric analysis and seeing that in order to be small and throw hard, you need to be a pretty terrific athlete. And the best athletes on the mound, not entirely, but for the most part, are the ones that repeat their deliveries the best. And the guys that repeat their deliveries consistently, if they also can develop multiple pitches, have a tendency to start. So I think that's why this has become less of an issue, even though Alex's research, and this was fascinating, shows that there actually were fewer starts by short pitchers last year than there were 10 years ago. And Dave Bush, who was quoted in the article, a former Red Sox pitching coach, it was like, that definitely does not track with where my mindset was. So I don't think it's that teams have started looking for the 6'3", 185-pound stud again over the shorter pitcher. I think this is just likely cyclical because, to your point on the number of international free agents that are undersized, and then add in these couple of you know, major league pitchers who have had very good careers in Gray and Stroman, you have seen more of a willingness to accept those guys if they have the functional strength to be able to repeat their deliveries.
So 2 points here. One, give me 2 minutes to explain why being short is helpful, depending on your arsenal. I want everyone to think about Spencer Strider, who is 6 foot tall. But what's important about Spencer Strider is the height at which he releases the baseball and the angle with which the baseball crosses the strike zone. That is something that is called vertical attack angle. Literally, the angle at which the degrees, right, at which the baseball enters the strike zone. You want that to be as short as possible, as small as possible, as flat of an entrance into the strike zone as possible if you are throwing a four-seam fastball with perfect spin axis end over end. It creates an illusion, like the pitch is rising, that no, and when it is at a lower release, it is even harder for hitters to pick it up and to hit that. And any pitch that Spencer Strider has, any fastball he's ever thrown at the top of the zone, is the perfect example of this, right? And so short pitchers with high ride, high carry fastballs, that release point, right, the shorter the pitcher, usually the lower that release point is going to be. And that is a great example when we're talking about Yuki Matsui, who doesn't really have like a uniquely low release point when you watch him, but because he's 5'8", it is simply coming at you short at a lower height versus the ground. Mm-hmm. So that is the thought process behind it. Now, if you are a sinker baller, you want to be as tall as possible and create as steep an angle as possible into the hitting zone, right? So that's just what something to think about.
Let me add just on that real quick. I mean, like, and I was actually having this conversation with our friend Kevin Franza today. Like, you can be tall and still get that flat angle. So, like, Jacob Mizorowski, who is one of the more exciting pitching prospects out of the Brewers organization, is 6'7", but his release height is very similar to what Christian Javier's is. And Javier is one of those pitchers that has what Jake's talking about with that flat angle fastball that plays at the top of the zone. It's just that Mizorowski has two more gears on his.
Right.
Like, you know, but, like, he throws 102, like, legitimately. So there are ways you can do it if you are a lower slot, tall guy, but it's much easier. It's much more natural for that shorter pitcher.
And then the reason I think we have taller pitcher, like, the reasoning behind Alex's data that we're seeing less, we're seeing fewer starts from short guys. As someone who coaches Little League, okay, I am culpable. When you are younger, the taller kids are stronger and more athletic almost usually, right? And those kids get pushed to the mound because they can throw harder and they have tend to have better body control at that age, right? And that bias just keeps on going as the kids get older, and the kids with more experience on the mound tend to be the better ones. Yes, Josiah Grays exist where they are shortstops who were converted in college. But as a whole, the entire baseball playing population, that bias towards really young, right? And I think it is on, I think it's on like people like me, believe it or not, to give all types of players the opportunity to try to pitch at a younger age so that we are creating more variation in what ends up in the major leagues.
I would just add that there is a pretty, I know oftentimes, and not that I blame Alex for kind of simplifying it and for the most part referring to under 6 feet, which is clearly rare, right? That at the, if you even just go with that baseline, but you know, just running a couple, you know, stat head searches now, like there is a massive difference between 5'10 and 5'8, or even 5'11 and 5'8. Like you even 5'11 and 5'10, you could argue in terms of just how many we've had starting games at that level. Like when you lower it to 5'8, and we don't expect Yuki Matsuda to be a starter, so I don't want to get too, you know, overhyping about him in particular, but even Yamamoto at 5'10, just looking at just the number of pitchers in a season that are 5'10 that have started a game, this past year we had six at 5'10. Mm-hmm. And that includes Stroman, that includes Sonny Gray, he's listed at 5'10, and then it includes a bunch of openers. I mean, Jose Suarez with the Angels, Justin Garza, Sam Mall, Austin Pruitt. You lower it to 5'8, it's basically just Stroman for the last 20 seasons. And that is why he, I mean, you mentioned Sonny Gray. Like, I remember Stroman's draft year even more so, where I was like, this is different. Yeah. And he has defied that to a pretty extreme degree.
You know why, right? Because height doesn't measure heart. Height doesn't measure
it
heart.
It does not. He's made that very clear. And we can roll our eyes all we want, but when he's defied it to this degree, it is hard. It is hard to hate too much. But I think
other part of his too is that, you know, like that idea of creating down angle and downward plane was everything in pitching development until the last 10 or so years. And so now that kind of invisible fastball at the top of the zone is something, you know, whether I don't think it was entirely Brent Strom, who's now the Diamondbacks pitching coach, but had been in the Astros pitching coach before that was in the Cardinals organization, was the one who, you know, introduced this. I mean, I remember as a kid, because I'm a lot older than you guys are, like in the 80s, which is not something that you're familiar with.
Is that a velocity range or a decade? I'm confused.
It was then. There were a lot more, it felt like, high fastballs that were thrown that guys could not lay off. And that in the 90s, as players got bigger and stronger for some injectable reason, the emphasis became on pounding the bottom of the zone. And so you saw that downward plane really become important. And creating down angle on the fastball was something that, I mean, it's still, you hear baseball people who know better have it just kind of slip out when talking about pitchers in general, as opposed to looking at these different ways. Really, we've created this different kind of kaleidoscope for pitchers now than what we had, which was you fit into a couple of small categories. And now I think teams and scouts are better evaluating what pitchers do well and trying to maximize that ability.
Yeah.
And I think when we're talking about command, I think it's easier for a shorter pitcher to like have good command. I would take just command. Okay. Just command and control. I would take all the people under 6 foot as a group versus 6'1 and over, because the shorter your limbs, the more control you tend to have over them as a whole. Yeah. That's not true for everybody. There are short people who don't know where their arms are, and there are tall people who, like,
who are Yuri Perez.
Yeah, Yuri Perez, right? And that, but
I thought
as a
you were
going
to say LeBron, because they tend to be playing a sport other than baseball when they're that
cool. I love that Jordan and I are like Yuri Perez at the exact same time. Yeah. But as a whole, like, I think shorter pitchers know where their arms are. And I think they're able to repeat their deliveries better. Spencer Strider is a physical freak, yeah, but he's a really, really good example of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say, like, it does, and getting back to Jake's point about, you know, coaching at the youth levels and who, I mean, both coaches at the level that Jake is, but also even at the high school level, and as we're actually getting closer to professional baseball, what kind of athletes are we looking to be on the mound more so than what their size is? Like, literally more about their movements and their balance as much as it is just like what are they actually physically built like is, I think, maybe a direction we're more likely to see. Well,
and there's a big difference between, you know, like going back what more than 10 years ago when Dellen Betances was one of the top prospects. Mm-hmm. And if you saw Betances, he never looked like the most coordinated dude on the mound. And then, you know, like say a Tyler Glasnow, who is much more athletic, although Glasnow had a lot of trouble repeating his delivery, and another guy who's super tall and had to figure out some tricks to be able to do it. And like even Randy Johnson at 6'10", who was a little bit lower arm slot, you know, he very famously, and if you get Randy to talk about it, he'll tell you, Tom House and Nolan Ryan noticed that I was landing on the heel of my foot, and then that was causing my fastball to spray all over the place. And then Randy will go on for 20 minutes about it. But, you know, like making adjustments there to try and take advantage of their size and their athleticism, sometimes it can be difficult, to Jake's point, when you have more arms and limbs.
Yeah.
That's why I'm short.
That explains
you just everything. Didn't want the big arms?
But yeah, my mom asked me. My mom said, listen, son,
but maybe
you want big arms? I said, no.
Maybe, you know, maybe we will, you know, someday have more. Again, like when you can see the Stromans and the Grays and, you know, Mike Leake was very successful. Chris Medlin comes to mind as a shorter pitcher who had a lot of success. Maybe we will have it. And Yamamoto, in some respects, will be one hell of a test case, although he is exceptional in ways that go far beyond his height, as we have certainly learned. Jake, I know you had one more topic you wanted to hit on before we say goodbye, or you wanna kill that?
I'm kind of done with you people. I mean, we've already gone 45 minutes. We got a whole winter of joy.
Okay. Well, since you teased it at the top, we can kick it to another show. But let's just do that. Okay. I know you wanted to talk about the 20/80 scale because it is something that we just throw around all the time. And we say, oh yeah, that guy's got 60 this and 45 that and 35 this. And it does seem like something that is worthy of a full topic. So we're going to push that to another prospect broadcast in the future.
35.
Don't assume
this,
though, that we know what we're talking about with that.
Yeah. Also 35 is a coward's grade. That's what I was taught.
I don't know. I'm a big 35 guy.
When it comes to overall future value or to a specific tool?
Specific, everything. I 35 is, seems like you two disagree. All right, well, we'll say
Jordan, like the half grades.
Jordan, as the kids say, you need to stand on business.
All right, well, on that note, we will push this argument over whether 35 is a real grade or not to the future, a future edition of Prospect Barbacast. Mike Farron, a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for joining us. I feel like I learned things. I hope you had an okay time.
I always have fun with you guys, and I always learn something too.
Oh, that's good. That seems absurd that we could ever offer that to you, but it is very humbling. I'm glad you had a good time. Jake Mintz, did you have a good time?
I had a great time, and we will be back on Friday with another edition of Baseball Barbacast. Mm-hmm. Before, Jordan, we head out for a little break.
Yeah. Oh, yes. We got some travel. We got all kinds of goo. I don't know what Mike's travel plans are. We're going to ask him as soon as we get off this podcast. but we will keep this feed alive, buzzing, because that's what Baseball Barbacast and Prospect Barbacast is all about. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. Thank you, Isabel Josen, for producing this. Jake Mintz, final words.
27.
All right, 27. Thank you. Goodbye.
SiriusXM Podcasts.